All right, so tonight I'd like to do a final talk on dependent origination. So Tuari and I have been exploring this with you this whole year, these 11 months, and all its nuances, taking each link 1 month at a time. And next month, next week, we'll start with a short a series on transcendent cycle. This is the cycle that's related to freedom. Just how dependent origination shows us suffering, that cycle shows us the path to freedom. And we hope that these last 11 months have been insightful and helpful for you, beneficial, because dependent origination is really one of the most important teachings of the Buddha, and also one of the most complex. And so it's helpful to come back to this again and again. So tonight I wanted to summarize dependent origination. And also share a framework in that we can start to group the links in a more simple way, see how they fit together as units, as they fit together as processes, especially looking at cause and effect, how cause has a certain result, and how dependent origination is really a teaching of conditionality. And also looking at the relationship between the past and the present and the future, and how these three elements really also show up in dependent origination. But all through the talk and all through this evening, and really all through our practice, we need to remember that the bottom line, the central line, is that how we relate to each moment matters. How we relate to this sensation, this breath, this thought, this emotion, this person. Each moment of arising, it matters how we relate to it. This is something that I really, a few years ago when I was studying this through my teacher training, really became aware of and very engaged with how this moment matters, how this moment inclines us either toward our suffering or toward our freedom, and how this is really a point of power. It's a point of influence that we can show up and meet this moment with our wisdom and with our compassion. Or we can meet it with our delusion, with our ignorance. So on the one hand, how this moment reveals itself, how it shows up, the contents of our minds, we're in some ways off the hook for that. Because it's already been pre-set up. It's been like you put a coin in the jukebox and we just have to let that music play out. It's programmed to show up in a certain way, what arises in this moment based on the input. Hearing a sound, hearing a sensation, sensing a sensation. So there's no need to judge the contents of your mind. Just judge what is actually present. So in that way, we're kind of off the hook that we don't have to carry this sense of, oh, I've messed up again because my mind is doing this same pattern. On the other hand, we're completely responsible. We're completely responsible for how we meet it, how we actually bring our practice to bear upon it, how we relate to it with clinging, with craving, with ignorance, or with wisdom, with compassion, with balance. This is how we think about it, how we act about it, how we speak from it. This inclines us toward our future suffering or our future freedom. So first, I'd like to share a few of the short phrases that the Buddha shared about the dependent origination and how important he placed it in his teachings. He said that whoever sees dependent origination sees the Dharma. Whoever sees the Dharma sees dependent origination. So he's saying this is the essential element of his teachings, of the Dharma itself, of how things are. Now, the Buddha, when he first became awakened, when he first had his deep realization, he was actually reluctant to teach. He was reluctant to share it with other people. And he was reflecting on this years later, saying, "Monks, the thought arose in me thus. This truth, which I have realized, is profound, difficult to see, abstruse, calming, subtle, and not attainable through mere sophisticated logic." I love that part. Not attainable through mere sophisticated logic. We can't think our way through this. We can't use our minds, our logic to figure it out. It asks a much deeper realization of it, a much deeper transformation. And the Buddha went out to say that, but beings revel in attachment, take pleasure in attachment and delight in attachment. For beings who thus revel, take pleasure and delight in attachment, this is an extremely difficult thing to see. That is the law of conditionality, the principle of dependent origination. Moreover, this is also an extremely difficult thing to see, the calming of all conditioning, the casting off of all clinging, the abandoning of desire, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to give this teaching and my words were not understood, that would simply make for weariness and difficulty. So he realized if he taught this and no one understood, it would be very, very disheartening, because it is subtle. It does require a level of passion, of interest to really understand it, to take it on beyond just a set of ideas, to actually see it for how it shows up in this moment. Now, dependent origination, we could sum up simply as the law of conditionality. And the Buddha summed it up this way. When there is this, that is. With the arising of this, that arises. When this is not, neither is that. With the sensation of this, that ceases. Okay, this is almost so obvious we overlook how profound it is, that when there is this, that is. When the arising of this, that arises. When this is not, neither is that. And with the sensation of this, that ceases. So this is a very simple formula. Applies to our suffering, to the sense of self, to how that is conditioned based on the whole dependent origination. And then finally, it's a fun part of the suttas. When Ananda, the Venerable Ananda, who was actually the Buddha's cousin and his attendant, he was with them, you know, all day long, attending to his needs, caring for him. And he also had a very photographic memory, so he was able to recall everything that the Buddha said. And so Ananda is exclaiming to the Buddha, "How amazing! Never before has it occurred to me, Lord, this principle of dependent origination. Although so profound and hard to see, it appears to me to be so simple." The Buddha responds, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. This principle of dependent origination is a profound teaching, hard to see. It is through not knowing, not understanding, and not thoroughly realizing this teaching that beings are confused like a tangled thread, thrown together like bundles of threads, caught as if in a net, and cannot escape hell, the nether worlds, and the wheel of samsara." So tonight we're going to try to take this complex teaching and wrap it all up for you. So you've kind of got our work cut out. And it is a process. It is a process. I first encountered this teaching probably 15 years ago. And each time I revisit it with a lot of interest and energy, there's a new understanding that arises from it. And so it will be with you, you know, that you learned, we can only take in as much as we can at any given time. And as our wisdom, as our experience grows, then we see the same teachings in a deeper way, because our experience starts to show us, oh, I can see that now. I can see it in a different way. Because dependent origination is such a important teaching. And it's something that we cannot understand just with our intellect. We can't just keep it as a set of theories, something that we hold intellectually. That is helpful to have that framework. But it comes down to be met in how does it show up in this moment, in this very moment of our lives, seen directly through our practice, and how it shows up in our lives, how it shows up in our minds. So the potential is to make it a very alive teaching. very alive teaching that's very relevant to every moment of your life. And I always remember this present moment is the gateway. It is the gateway into this understanding. This is where the teachings come alive. All the teachings come alive. Away from the concepts of the mind to how does it actually show up in this mind, this body, and this heart. And this is this moment, this very moment is where our practice, our point of power is. It's our point of influence, our point of choice. It's how we meet this moment that matters, regardless of what that moment holds. Some moments are very, very difficult to hold because of our circumstances and the difficulty of our history or conditioning. And yet, we can still practice. We can still find a place of practicing with those. So this present moment is the gateway. Emily Dickinson said, "Forever is composed of nows. Forever is composed of nows." And then A.A. Milne said, quoting the famous Winnie the Pooh books, "What day is it?" asked Pooh. "It's today," squeaked Piglet. "My favorite day," said Pooh. "My favorite day." So being in the moment, this has almost become cliche in our modern day society. You know, live in the moment, live for the moment, be present. We hear that, you know, cross-culturally, across all kinds of, it becomes a marketing, a rallying cry. And yet it resonates with something very deep in us. You know, there's a resonance that we recognize that most people recognize, whether they've practiced Buddhism or Dharma, they recognize that when they're stressed, when they're worried, their minds are often going into the future, into the anticipation of what may be, or going into the past of the remorse, the regret, or even just the longing for those moments to try to bring those forth. There's an intuitive sense that I think we get that is where some of our stress lies, if not all our stress. And often we confuse the present moment with our projections of the future, the anticipation, the excitement, the dread, the worry. We project our past upon the moment, you know, seeing through our conditioning, through our trauma is a very painful way, a very powerful way that we change the moment based on our past history. And learning, we also sense that if we learn to relax into the moment, to actually find some way of orienting ourselves to this moment, if we can land here and now, and relax into it, there is a peace. There's an ease that's available. Even if that moment is difficult, relaxing into the moment provides a place of refuge, a place of landing. Because all there really is this moment. It's just one moment after another. Certainly the effects of past moments create the home or the place you're staying, this computer that you're listening through, these are all past effects that are coming into this moment. In the future, you know, what's the next thing that's going to happen in your life? What's going to happen tomorrow? The next thing I'm going to say is out in the future. And we tend to kind of connect those dots. But there's still this very moment, this very middle of this moment. And the future is just a series of potential moments that we're waiting to arise, that we anticipate, waiting to take birth. And the past is a series of moments, faded, only living in our memory, in our history, all the past births that have died, that have passed away. And so we struggle to try to be in this moment, to fully arrive in this moment, because we know also that our actions right now, today, will affect our future, affect our tomorrow, whatever time frame we look at, whether it's the next moment, the next day, the next year, the next 20 years, 30 years. We know that our choices today shape and create my future to some extent. Usually not the way we anticipate exactly, but there is some way that it influences it. It changes it. And so naturally, much of our energy goes to focusing on the future with our thoughts, our plans, our actions. We also realize that our past actions affect how today shows up, how it manifests, and how our past affects the future. This is very clear to see. I mean, this is an obvious thing that we can see. The choices I made provides this place that I'm living in, and I have to live in it. I have to learn how to navigate that for better or worse. So naturally, we tend to reflect, review, obsess over our past. And yet, the moment is the only place that life is actually happening. The moment is the only place that things are actually happening. This moment, this point of power. All the things we anticipate, and once they finally arrive, that's when we're living it. We confuse anticipation of living to actually the point of when it's there, when it's present. Certainly the moment is influenced by our past and shaped by our past, and the future is shaped by our present. And so what does this have to do with dependent origination? And with this study of the cycle of dependent origination? What has everything to do with it? I like to step back with dependent origination and divide it very simply into two main groups. All of the 12 links, all those different links that's hard to keep in your mind, into links that are causes and results, causes and effects. This points again to the Buddha's fundamental teaching. One of the defining features of his teaching is this, what's called the causal conditionality. You know, if there's this, then there's that. If not this, then not that. You know, things arise because of conditions, and they pass away when those conditions are not there. And Buddha emphasized this. He said that whether I'm here or not, this condition exists and is a natural fact and natural law. That is the principle of conditionality. This suchness, monks, this invariability, this irreversibility, that is to say, this law of conditionality, I call the principle of dependent origination. So taking these 12 links and dividing them, into seeing how they fall into causes and results. Now, the cause links, these are links that we have some choice over, that we have some influence, some volitional choice, like I can choose how to react. It's almost like a fork in the road when I can go choice A or choice B. So it has a double edge that we have this choice. It's often driven, but it's often driven by our habits, driven by our conditioning, our ignorance. So sometimes we don't realize that we actually have that choice because it's just in the middle of reacting. You know, benefits of mindfulness and slowing down, that pause, is to pause and say, oh, here's this choice right in front of me. It's almost like these. Remember on websites, you know, you have those hot links. I don't know if they're still called that, but when you put your mouse, your cursor over it, and there's a little thing that lights up and you click on that, you suddenly go to a different page. It goes to a different direction. So it's like these links in dependent origination, when we act on them, they have this potential to take us someplace else. They set this wheel of samsara conditionality in motion. Because it has that intentionality, that volitional choice. I'm choosing to do this. I'm clicking on that button, and I find myself in a different page on the web. And in this way, they're karmically charged. So karma is one of those words that we'll unpack a little bit later tonight. But basically, karma simply means action, particularly volitional action, a choice to act in a certain way, has a karmic energy to it, a potential to move, to shape how the future will unfold. So there's about half the links are these volitional ones, these links that have our choice in them. The other half of the, about the other half of the links are the results of those choices. Okay, so it's not as clear as I choose this and then right away this other thing pops up. It's often these choices that I made a long time ago. The conditioning may be from childhood and the way I learned to relate to the world, the way society told me how I was supposed to be as a person in this world, whatever demographic or shape I might be. There's these forces that shape us in how we should be or shouldn't be. This is part of that conditioning, right? So that the links are like, these are the links that are the results, the outcomes of those choices. So we click on that hot link on the web, suddenly you're on this other page. That page is the result of your action, the action of your clicking. This is like the jukebox. You've put your coin in, you've pushed your button, and those songs just have to play out. They have to play till the record is over. And you may have pushed those buttons years ago. You may have set those up and they're just kind of waiting to be activated, to being brought forth. We may not even be paying attention in that moment. We may have been caught in a level of reactivity or wanting or craving and not realizing we're actually preconditioning, predisposing ourselves for this moment to rise in a certain way. Because it's really a complex set of buttons. It's like a toddler hitting a computer and hitting all these buttons randomly, and all this stuff happens within your program. That's really beyond our capacity to understand the complexity. And the Buddha would often say that when people wanted to understand karma, the law of karma, he would say it's beyond what anyone who's not awakened, fully awakened, can understand, because it's so complex. And so with this kind of basic division of cause and effect, we have also can look at past, present, and future. We have past causes, current results, and we have present causes and future results. The past, present, and future. Now, as we start to move into December, you know, those of us who might practice, you know, some version of Christian holidays like Christmas time, there's of course the famous story by Dickens, The Christmas Carol. The Christmas Carol actually has a level of teaching on it, which I find very helpful to pull on in this idea of past actions, present results, and future results. Remembering Ebenezer Scrooge and being visited by the three ghosts, the ghost of the Christmas past, showing him his actions, the way he was in his past lives, basically, how he was when he was a student and his relationships and being a apprentice and all those qualities and how that started to shape how he was right there, being a miser, being alone. This is the past actions created this present, right? This is the present. It was shown how he was alienated and alone, how he was thought ill of by his employee, Bob Cratchit. And then, of course, going into the future, how his actions, if they continued, would change, have a certain direction of his life to go. And he saw how dismal and alone, how devastating that can be. And so this almost an archetypal story, this almost mythology of this story that Dickens created, shows us how the dependent origination shows up. The past history shapes how this present moment is. It may be a beautiful moment, it may be a terrible moment, but the past conditions, the choices, the way we've lived our lives shape how this moment shows up. And how we meet this moment then sets us up for how the future will unfold. Again, it's not a one-for-one ratio. It's not like one good thing means one good thing in the future and one bad thing means a bad thing in the present. It's simply, it's very complex, but we start to incline our ways that way. There's certainly their actions of our bodies, of our minds, or choices we make are a huge part of this. But from a very essential level, it's really where our minds go. Because our minds are the forerunner. If any action, anything that I do with my body, anything that I speak, anything that I think, the mind is what starts that. And that's the point of practice as meditators, is to come right down here to this very moment of what is my mind doing? What am I adding fuel to? What am I releasing the fuel from? This is just the lesson that Ebenezer Scrooge learned, is that the present was really the point of power, as he rejoiced to realize it wasn't too late, that he can actually change how he acts, changes his heart. How our choices here and now influence our future. How our choices in the past influence how our present is. So how we relate to this present moment, this matters. This is the teachings of kama, of karma or kama. This is the point of power of when we act. Now karma or kama is really the sense of action. Is all that means is the choice that I do. Action means what I think, what I speak, and what I do with my body. And often, as Westerners, have a little bit of a distorted view of karma, like it's my karma that this happened to me. And things sometimes just happen. It's not your fault that you've done something bad in your past and this terrible thing has happened. Sometimes that may be true, but sometimes it just happens. Sometimes nature acts in a certain way. Things happen. So I think it's much more helpful to look at it from this moment by moment. How do I choose to think? How do I choose to act? A couple of weeks ago, I shared some of the five daily reflections. And the last reflection is that I am the owner of my actions, my karma, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related through my actions, and have my actions as my arbitrator. Whatever I do, for good or for evil, to that I will fall heir. This is the fifth fact that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. This heir to our actions. And this really is what dependent origination is all about, is seeing those places that we act and that create this potentiality for our future freedom or our future suffering. So just to bring that big overall concept of cause and effect down to these links for a few minutes. So we can look at cause in the past, our past causes. And here we have the links of ignorance and volitional impulses, the sankharas. Okay, so our ignorance, our basic misunderstanding of the nature of life, particularly around the three characteristics of impermanence, of dukkha, and of non-self, that misunderstanding of that ignorance shapes the very way we act, the very way we be in the world. This is the fundamental cause to attend to. And the volitional impulses, the actual way we engage with, the way we do that, that's how the ignorance takes shape. Right? So it may seem like that's very, I don't know, obtuse perhaps, but you can see that very directly. When you see, let's say you want something and you just know, let's say you're allergic to wheat, for example, but you see those cookies, those holiday cookies, and they look so good. And you ignore that fact. And so you eat those cookies and you get an upset stomach. You know, it's like that action to act on that, even though the ignorance, you know, you knew that it was perhaps not the best thing for your body. So the past cause of ignorance, volitional impulses, then this creates the present result. The result of what this moment is like. So these are all those links which seem perhaps a little subtle when we're teaching at this last year of consciousness, of body and mind, of Namarupa, of the sense bases, of contact and feeling. So this is the way that we actually perceive the world. What things we are paying attention to, what things do we ignore? What things are we inclined to like or find pleasant? What things are you inclined to find unpleasant? Even the way that we label something, we label that as a cat or a dog or as a tree or as someone who's other. That's that name and form, the way that's conditioned. The consciousness shows the shape of what we actually are attending to. The sense data, sense bases, you know, which senses are we active in? Are we just in our minds? Are we also open to sound or to sensation in this moment? And all that creates this environment for a moment of contact to happen, to actually hear something, to sense something, to think something. And that moment of contact arises, then there's that inherent flavoring of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's inherent, but it's very conditioned by our history, by our past actions, by our ignorance and volitional impulses. I mean, a simple example is the bell ringing. Before you start to meditate, you could hear this, you know, and may not have much of an impulse around it. You know, it may just be a sound, maybe pleasant or unpleasant. And as a meditator, you know, especially if you're sitting and your body's getting uncomfortable, you hear that sound and you have, by your history, by your past experience, you register it as being pleasant or unpleasant. Or perhaps you're meditating and it feels so deep and so still, and the sound says, oh, it's time to come out, and there's a quality of unpleasantness. So that even Vedana, even that feeling tone, is also conditioned, is also shaped by our past history. So past causes of ignorance, volitional impulses, creates this present kind of inclination of how we meet this moment, how we sense the moment, our consciousness, our name and form, the senses that we activate or turned on, what we have contact with through those senses, through our eyes, our ears, our nose, and then pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. That's the present result. Okay, so that's how this moment shows up, what comes up in your mind when you're meditating. When you see someone you find reactive, that's all conditioned. Then how we relate to that, creates the present cause. Okay, so this is back to that point of power, is how do we meet that irritating sound, that longing for the holiday cookie, whatever it might be, that longing, that moving away from, right? That becomes the present cause. So craving, clinging, becoming. So that's the point of really similar to the volitional impulses that's happening right here, right now. Volitional impulses are what happened in the past around clinging and craving and becoming. So I see something that's pleasant and I start to move toward it. I start to want it. And I start to become more obsessed with it. That goes from craving to clinging, like I need to have it. And the sense of me starts to really depend upon having it. Quality of becoming. I tend to have a bit of an interesting mind that has some craving elements. And sometimes I would be just, you know, going about my day and I hear a certain word or I see a certain video or something, and suddenly my mind kind of inclines around it. I can see my whole world shaping around needing more of that, wanting more of that point of interest. There's like these kind of background hobbies that I kind of forget about and they kind of arise. It's like that first sound, I start to move toward it, I become more interested, and then before I know it, I'm looking up things on the web about it, or I'm starting to watch videos about it or getting books about it. That's going into that quality becoming. Okay? That predisposes that to come. Same thing with something negative. Painful past experience. You know, when that starts to arise, how I relate to it can create more and more of that contraction and suffering and create the quality of that to arise again. So the present moment shows itself and how we relate to it is the present cause. Okay, that cause then creates the result. The result is taking birth, is taking a sense of identification. I am the one who's wanting. I am the one who's not wanting. I'm the one who has to, this sense of identity has taken birth. And with that, there's the aging, there's the death of that. And then there's the sorrow, the lamentation, the pain, the grief that comes with that. This is the suffering that arises from taking birth. And so we can see how past choices, volitional impulses fueled by our ignorance shapes how this moment arises, and then how we meet that moment then shapes our future. And so this cycle continues again and again. So how do we work with this? How do we find some way of finding peace and ease or freedom even, you know, beyond just the suffering, but beyond that, where's the freedom that the Buddha discovered? And the fundamental way is to develop a love affair with the present moment, to develop a love affair with how this moment actually is. To quote Henry David Thoreau, you must live in the moment, or you must live in the present. Launch yourself on every wave. Find your eternity in each moment. Fools stand on their island of opportunities and look toward another land. There's no other land. There's no other life but this. Or as Walt Whitman said, happiness, not in another place, but this place. Not for another hour, but this hour. So developing this love affair for the present moment. This is when meditation stops being a chore. We stop saying, okay, I have to keep releasing my thoughts and my fantasies. And I actually start to open to this present moment. Open to the mystery and the wonder of how each moment arises. Something that is simple and mundane as the breath can hold this beauty in it, this wonder in it, this mystery in it. Hearing the bird song, relating to a loved one or a total stranger. And to get there, we have the meditation instructions. One of the first instructions we hear is to meet this moment as it is, to meet it not through our preference or our judgment or what we want or don't want, but actually meet it how it actually is, to learn to meet this moment with non-resistance, with non-judgment, with a complete quality of allowance. So this is allowing us to come right into this present moment. This is actually a profound teaching, profound instructions for meeting this moment and starting to undo our karmic momentum. Because if we're meeting this moment just directly and immediately and not trying to do anything with it, not trying to make it last longer or get rid of it, what we're not doing is adding fuel to this karmic wheel. We're not adding fuel to our sankharas, adding fuel through our craving and clinging. Are becoming. This is the key aspect of around selfing and karma, this intentionality. Okay, I am doing this, I'm wanting this. And it's learning how to meet this moment just how it is, whether a moment contains fantasy or worry, despair or joy. Just to meet it, meeting it without not acting on it, doing nothing with it other than simply being present for. And yes, absolutely, we have to care for our lives. We have to make choices that help, you know, help better our own lives and the lives of our loved ones and the world as a whole. Yes, this doesn't exclude that. But we're learning how to relate to this moment, to develop this love affair for this very moment. How do I actually meet what's here right now? And meeting it without doing anything with it, without acting it, it's not easy. It's because there's such a momentum. Like we often, when we just be still with something, we almost feel the pain that's being covered up by it. It's like stubbing your toe and dancing around on one foot, yelling and cursing. It doesn't make the pain go away. It just distracts us from that pain. And simply being still and feeling the pain, we're actually starting to feel in a more direct way that deep hunger to be, that tanha, the deep experience of craving, of wanting. Really starting to feel the lack that drives all this. Feeling the lack is starting to show this underlying ignorance, this underlying delusion. And when we start to see through that, we realize the deep sufficiency of the moment and how this sense of inner lack is a constant momentum of our suffering. So it starts to quiet this wheel of samsara. We start to meet the moment naturally, how it actually is. And just to finish, With the words of the Buddha again. When a noble disciple thus fully sees the rising and cessation of the world as it is, he or she is said to be endowed with perfect view, with perfect vision, to obtain the true Dharma, to possess the initiate's knowledge and skill, to have entered the stream of Dharma, to be a noble disciple, replete with the purifying knowledge, one who is at the very door of the deathless. All right, if you could just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle. All right, before we open to any questions or comments that you might have, I'd like to just talk about the practice and reflection for this week. So this is an important way for you to take the teachings and engage in your life, engage in practice. We won't have a chance to do a discussion because the timing, we'll have a talk next week, but here it is. So I just put it in the chat. So how does the content of this moment represent the effects of your past actions? Okay. Try to key in on the actual mind, the mental aspect. The physical has its applies to it also, but sometimes the physical gets a little more confusing. Try to come right into this, how this mind shows up. It could be as simple as, this is the wrong season for it, but if you hear the ice cream truck and how something reacts to that, how that's conditioned based on hearing that sound, your past history. Now, how does the moment represent the effects of your past actions? You know, for both the positive, the joyous ones, the pleasant ones, and also the painful ones. Try to hold them both in balance so you don't just see the negative, but also see the positive. And then how does your present moment's actions, this again, action is how you think, how you speak and how you act in your body, incline your future mind's contents. So this is the nitty gritty. This is the point of power. How I relate to this moment, does it matter? Does it matter if I indulge in that fantasy or indulge in that berating that other person? How does that shape how the moment will arise in the future? And try to see this cause and effect in very simple and immediate examples from your life. And try to boil it down to something that you can actually see. Again, much of this is going to happen in a very, long range, like childhood relationships, childhood experiences affect this moment very profoundly. So you can see that influence of how this moment shaped. And try to see, how do I relate to this moment? How does it predispose the next moment? And you may not see that for a while, maybe not till the next time the ice cream truck goes by that you realize, oh, there's craving. And I have a choice of whether I get lost in that or not. All right, so we have a chance for any comments or questions. And you're welcome to either raise your hand, either your virtual blue hand. It would be a nice way to do it. I can see it. Or you could wave your hand on the screen, but I can only see about a third of you at a time. Or you can also just unmute yourself if you like. Okay, Alan, go ahead.
Hi, Tim. So with dependent origination, from what I've heard and am able to understand, the cycles can go by very quickly. You can go through a cycle, very quickly until you're lost and becoming and birth. And then a cycle begins again. And I'm trying to capture kind of the gap when I'm not in dependent, in this cycle or, and I'm trying to understand and I'm trying to get a grasp on just how I know we spend most of our lives in this cycle, but if we are able to stay in the present moment for some time, is that time where we're not in the cycle of dependent origination?
Yes, I mean, that's a great question, because it does go by, it can happen in microseconds, you know, just suddenly we're in this midst of this becoming and birthing, because it's almost like a mousetrap. The spring is set and we touch that cheese and boom, we're in the midst of that, you know, that state of birth. So that often happens, and sometimes it's very helpful just to start to incline yourself to noticing when you're kind of in a suffering mood, you know, or a mode, when the present moment has that gritchiness to it, that difficulty. Often that, you know, that's going to catch our attention more, because we don't like to suffer, right? We don't like to have our minds mm-hmm. caught up in anger or depression or jealousy, you know, comparing all those different, whatever your favorite flavors of those are. When you notice that, you are in the midst of a birth right there. You're midst of a state of becoming and birth and that kind of cycling upon itself. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you realize that, though, you can step back a little bit. So that stepping back is also a volitional action. It's actually a sankhara that leads toward freedom. So you step back and just observe. So by observing, you're no longer so enmeshed and so lost in that state. So that's a one principle way to work with it, is when in the midst of that, is to notice that when you're really caught in a state. You can also start to notice it when things are, like you talked more about, you also talked about when you're more naturally quiet, when you're more in the middle of practice, there's not such a, things aren't so stirred up. You're just naturally calm, naturally attentive. The level of concentration is naturally there. You can start to notice the subtle leaning towards something. Okay, you notice how, okay, something's maybe noticing that being pleasant or unpleasant. Noticing how the mind starts to gear up to get more engaged in it. Mm-hmm. So you start to notice that movement of engagement. And right there, again, is the positive sankharas. Volitional choice of observation and choosing not to follow that, but just to observe that. And another way to work with it is noticing when something comes into registers in one of your senses, how your mind quickly identifies it and labels it. And practice letting go of that label. So you're just directly experiencing it. I often teach this with sound. As a sound arises, like I'm hearing a car go by right now on my street, the idea of car is that name and form. The name and form then predisposes me to liking or not liking it. So that back to that Bahia Sutta, in this hearing, there's just the hearing. So you can learn to kind of peel off the labels, the ideas of sound, of that sound. Same thing with body. You know, here's my body and my ideas around it. Same thing with a sense of me, like the different roles that you take up, you know, as whatever, whether you're a parent or your work or you're a son or whatever it might be, a spouse, all those roles come up. But you can notice how there's identification that's layered on that. And so you can see that, and then you're no longer so enmeshed in it. And so those are some ways to work with that. And to answer your last question, you said that when your things are quiet, you're not really engaged in the dependent origination. It depends how quiet you really are. So we can be a very quiet, you know, the witness, the sense of the witness is just observing everything. But if you're identified in that witness, there's just a very subtle way that the dependent origination is still happening. We're still taking birth. It just happens to be a very subtle, quiet sense of the meditator. And ultimately, even that falls away where there's no sense of identification. There's no place that we can call I, me, or mine. Not as an intellectual exercise, but as a direct realization. And then that moment, the dependent origination is quieted. It's not there. Does it help, Alan? There's a lot of words at you there.
Yeah, no, that was very helpful, Tim. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. I thought I saw a blue hand, but now it's gone. Anybody else? And go in and mute yourself, Alan. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Leslie.
I was thrilled by Alan's question, and because it really reminded me pretty strongly of something I think I read with Stephen Batchelor, where he describes that deep gap that you were talking about, Alan, that deep gap where you are quiet as being an experience of nirvana. That's how he labels that moment. And as Tim, as you say, if it's deep, then you're deep into nirvana. And does that comport with your understanding at all?
Yes. And, you know, there's kind of a different, I guess, depths of that. That there's a depth that I think we're talking about right now when there's simply, it just is not arising at all, that movement toward or away, that quality of craving and clinging just is not arising at all. And that's a much deeper realization or deeper shift of perspective. But I think what, you know, Stephen Batchelor was talking about, and also there's this great talk by Ajahn Buddhadasa, when he talked about everyday nibbana. And nibbana is actually, in Pali, apparently is a word that's used just day to day, just meaning a churning out, a quenching, a cooling. And how actually in any moment, there's actually many sense datas that we're not really being activated around, that they don't catch our attention often because we're kind of focused on what we're really wanting or not wanting. If we start to attune to this moment and how there's things which we just can observe or sense, that is also this everyday nibbana, that moment by moment quenching. And so I think it's also important to realize that and see that, because otherwise it seems like it's this unattainable goal. You know, and really the Buddha taught it because he said, you know, I wouldn't teach it unless you could also obtain it. And we can start to get senses of that, start to notice it, actually attune our attention to when we are naturally more quiet and how our relationship to life right there is simply one of ease. There's not needing life to be anything other than it actually is. And notice how there's not the movement toward or away. There's simply the abiding with. And that's that gap that I think Stephen Batchelor was talking about. That's the gap of that everyday nibbana. And that actually is very common. We just tend to kind of gloss over it. If we start to relate to it that way, the more attention we bring to it, the more those become more common. And eventually then there's this deeper falling away. Does that help, Leslie?
That was splendid. Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. All right, Brooke.
So I have a question. At the beginning of the year, when we still got to meet in person, there was a poster board with the dependent origination cycle on it. And after birth, aging, and death, or was suffering and transcendental. I don't know if that was the next thing after that in terms of a phase, or if you could talk more about that and what exactly that means.
Sure. So the 12 links of dependent origination, you know, end with aging and death.
Okay.
And then there's this outflow that pops out with grief, with suffering, with lamentation. Those are kind of outflows of that, this whole cycle. And that predisposes us then to go into the next link, which is the first link of ignorance. It strengthens that link. Now, I think the reason that Tori made that poster is there's also this other opportunity of going into what's called transcendental or transcendent origination. And that's what we're going to talk about in December. is exploring those links. And it's another way of phrasing how to get off this cycle. But it's really important to that suffering is kind of the result of this whole cycle. And that suffering then re-ups or reinforces our ignorance, which then reinforces our volitional activity, and it goes into that whole cycle, starts over again.
So the suffering would be in a causal column and the transcendental would be in a results column, or they wouldn't, neither of them are in the columns?
Well, I mean, you could certainly say the suffering is kind of the big result. The biggest result. I mean, remember, dependent origination is a very detailed way of describing the second noble truth, the origination of dukkha, the origination of suffering. So like suffering and dependent origination, suffering, selfing, dependent origination, they're all part of the same process, right? Well, the transcendental cycle is the one that's a whole different cycle, different way of practicing that's outside of dependent origination. We'll talk about that next week.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome, Brooke. All right, Alan, you want to follow up? Go ahead.
Different question, Tim. Don't want to bogart more time, but you said something that I don't know if I caught all of, but it seemed interesting. You said something about consciousness takes the form of what we're paying attention to, what we pay attention to, and something. I think I know what you mean, but it's kind of stood out for me, and I wanted to ask what exactly you meant by that.
Sure. Yeah. So consciousness. So there's different ways we can use that word consciousness, but from dependent origination's perspective, we're really looking at how we have those six senses, you know, so our normal senses we're familiar with, plus the mind. So right now, as we're talking, you know, how aware are you of sound or of smell or of taste? And so our attention has to kind of inhabit and activate that sphere of consciousness. So we have to have like the ear consciousness, the eye consciousness, the nose consciousness, the mind consciousness has to be kind of turned online, basically. And once that consciousness is there, then we're kind of predisposed to pay attention to those things. And if we're not really paying attention to it, then it just goes past our awareness. And so that way, and that consciousness, what we tend to highlight, what we tend to pay attention to, is really conditioned. It's really shaped by our experience. So again, going back to the meditation, if you're sitting and your body's uncomfortable and you're waiting for that bell to ring, ear consciousness, hearing consciousness is really highlighted. You know, you're really leaning into the moment to hear that bell. Or, you know, perhaps, you know, it could be a different consciousness that's arising. And once that's shaped, then that shapes what we're going to see, what we're going to sense, and then what name we're going to form to it, and then what we like it or dislike it, the whole cycle takes off. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, consciousness, I mean, the Buddha often talked about how we create the world. You know, it's not like we're some kind of magical, super, you know, human person, but just the very world that we inhabit, that we pay attention to, that we experience, is created by our minds. And consciousness, you know, again, we're using this kind of narrow definition of ear consciousness, eye consciousness, etc., is a big way that we create that world. You know, what we turn on and what we highlight. And as meditators, learning to balance out those fields is so helpful. You know, when we're caught in our minds, when we're caught in a quality of maybe traumas being reactivated, learning to highlight a different element of consciousness, which is naturally more calm, that's not so charged, is so beneficial to learn to find that place of stability to meet the difficulty of our lives. All right. Thank you, Alan. All right, looks like we had a few chats going on. Okay, so Rob had one, his mic wasn't working. Can you talk a bit about seeing the lack that you mentioned at the end of your talk? Yeah, seeing the lack, seeing this, that's, I was kind of bringing forth a quality of kind of a fundamental aspect of delusion, of ignorance. That, and to kind of bring this kind of back, kind of zoom back out for a second, you know, when we, how often do we chase after something, whether it's, you know, a physical experience, a physical thing or an experience or a relationship, a role, you know, a taste, a sight, a smell, we're chasing after it because there's a sense of inadequacy. Something's wrong with this moment. And if I get that thing, that relationship, that status, whatever it might be, then I'll be happy. I mean, this is a common story we tell ourselves, right? Because sometimes we wake up after spending decades chasing something and realize I'm still not satisfied, or it's not lasting in the same way because it's inherently dukkha. So we don't see that basic unsatisfactoriness is actually not dependent. It's not, has anything to do with those conditions. A nice way to play with this is find a common thing that you tend to find attractive. You know, it might be other people, it might be music, it might be something that you really long after. And something that's a little hard to obtain is really helpful. Because then you can't really obtain it very easily. And you can actually feel the longing activate, the wanting activate. And then say, okay, I'm going to let go of that object and come into the experience of wanting. And if you start to disengage the object from the wanting, you can start to feel, okay, what's the hunger that I'm trying to fill? What am I trying to fulfill here? And you start to get a sense of this almost existential insufficiency of inadequacy, of lack, and that you're trying to fill it with these external things. And you realize that nothing I can fill that internal lack. Because that's that fun, and even deeper than that is that fundamental sense of separation. That when I look out with the delusion of self and other, of separation, there's inherent lack. When that I see through that illusion and see the inherent unity, the inherent oneness, that lack falls away. And there's an inherent sufficiency. And once you start to get a taste of that, then that has this transformational effect on your practice and how you relate to life. You go through life and you're feeling that sense of, okay, inadequacy and lack. You realize, oh, I'm acting from this world, this view of separation, of isolation. And where can I see through that? Where can I see the inherent oneness that's underneath that? All right, does that help? Thank you, Rob. All right. So thank you for your questions and engagement. It really helps to flesh out the talk and bring it into your practice, because that's the bottom line. Is how does, we can talk all day long, but how do you see this in your own lives? That's what really matters. That's the point of practice, the point of power. And there's so many different ways this shows up. And so, you know, articulating it and exploring it, I know it's often a risk to speak. So thank you for those who shared and those everyone who listened. So we have a few announcements. And also before we do that, I want to just say a few words about Donna. We try to say this once a month or so. So Donna, you know, again, is the Pali word for generosity. Generosity is something that, it's a, going back to the talk, it's that volitional choice of how do I act in relationship to the world, one of lack, of scarcity, of isolation, or coming from a place of interconnection, a sense of seeing how my actions do affect others. And so this is this much broader teachings that, you know, regardless of Sims and teacher Donna, it's just Donna as a whole of a relationship to life, to learning how the Buddha emphasized generosity as a fundamental part of his teachings. Generosity, ethical conduct, and wisdom. These three elements are a foundational part of our practice. And there is reality, the relative reality that Sim's shadow insight and the teachers rely on your voluntary support, your support of generosity, you know, whatever shape that is. It doesn't matter, you know, what amount. Some people give, you know, give what is possible for you, what's appropriate. It may be a small monetary amount, but that's coming from your heart. That's the cycle, completing the cycle of generosity. If you have more means, that's also part of that. So it's really an individual relationship with Donna for supporting the teachers, supporting the organizations. So, you know, use it not just as an obligation, but as something as an alive teachings. All right, so I thank you for your generosity for Sims and for the teachers. And I just put that in the chat. Yeah. All right, good night, everyone.
Good night.